Back, ladies and gentlemen, and happy new year. This is, of course, the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. As always, I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan, joined by my two compatriots. There is Nick Newman, associate editor for the Film Stage.
Howdy.
And writer for the Film Stage, Danny King.
Hello there.
Hello. It is currently 3:16 Eastern Standard Time. It is December 31st. It is New Year's Eve. This is our last recording of the year 2014, and because at some point society sat down and collectively decided that this was a thing that had to happen, we're going to be giving you our top 10 films of 2014. I'm sure they will diverge wildly, as always. We'll have some caveats, but at first I wanted to just say Happy New Year. You will be listening to this after the New Year, so I hope you all had a safe and wonderful New Year's. I know that I will not have. So, just looking forward to that. This is legitimately the last sober moments of the year for me. So, that's going to be fun. It was a lot of personal will not to like begin drinking before this podcast. On that note, we're hoping to do our much talked about but yet to actually occur drunk podcast sometime early next year. So, keep your ears out for that. As always, we welcome your comments and questions and other statements, either via email at podcast@thefilmstage.com or on Twitter at @filmstageshow. And we do love so much to get comments and ratings on iTunes, so please do that. Other than that, we're going to give you our personal top tens, doing our usual round robin thing. And then we will be moving on to honorable mentions, and then that'll be it. We're going to forgo things like the week ahead or personal things that we've seen that we think you should check out, because this will be long enough without all of that shit in there too. So settle in, hope you enjoy it. I guess I want to say that on a personal note, I won't be including anything that I saw during my time at Toronto. You can see all my reviews on the Film Stage. You can listen, if you're an iTunes subscriber, to my audio dispatches. I would say that if I had decided to put some of those on there and be that asshole, I probably would have done Alive. I also would have done Confession and probably Magical Girl. So that's three films that just couldn't be on this list because I didn't think it was fair.
May I?
Yeah, I was about to say, Nick, I know that you had an amendment as well.
I had a few, partially because I realized once my top 10 list was in its final form that 70% of the top 10 premiered in 2013, and I only saw a few 2015 titles this year. Those would be Mia Hansen Loves Eden, Olivier Assayas's Clouds of Souls Maria, Spike Lee's The Sweet Blood of Jesus, all great films, all movies that would be contenders for my 2014 list, but I decided to exclude them in the sake of fairness to movies that were already kind of not behind the curve necessarily, but movies that actually
wide release in 2014,
or at the very least released. There is one title that is technically undistributed, but I can let a technicality. I can use a technicality to let it in.
Okay, so that's fine. I'd also like to say that I have not been able to see a couple of movies that who knows could be up there. Inherent Vice, for instance, Two Days, One Night, Force Majeure, and American Sniper, I'll just throw in, because that's an obvious prestige awards film. Sorry about that. Other than that, Danny, did you have any kind of disclaimers you wanted to do before we jumped into this?
I'm always confused, actually, as to what technically qualifies as an undistributed film.
Okay.
But I know the best, either the best or the second best new film I saw this year was probably Abel Ferrara's Welcome to New York, which is still without a distributor, I think, or it has a distributor, but it doesn't have a date. So that's a shame. And then there are a few films I saw at the New York Film Festival, like Heaven Knows What, another Ferrara film, Pasolini, and this film, Howha, starring Viggo Mortensen. those are all films that will probably qualify for my list next year. But I left them off. I stuck with the U.S. release date.
Excellent. All right. Well, all those disclaimers out of the way, let's get down to brass tacks and fucking do this thing. So, Danny King, give us your number 10 film of the year.
Okay. My number 10 is my one cheat.
Okay.
It is a double bill.
Oh, well, I did that last year. That's fine.
Okay. Of Nonstop and A Walk Among the Tombstones.
Yes.
I just love this run that Liam Neeson is on in terms of working with these sort of B-movie directors that are just really good. He's got another one coming up with Colette Sarah in 2015 called Run All Night.
Perfect.
But I think these two films, they both have third acts that I think are flawed. The villain reveal in Nonstop is kind of silly. And
do you have any idea how easy this was?
Yeah.
Yeah, love it.
And then the way they kind of integrate the 12 steps in the Tombstones climax, I didn't really love. But
oh, I loved that.
I know you did. But either way, these are two of like the studio releases that I would rewatch probably sooner than anything else. And I think they're both directed really well. And it's just, I really wanted to put them on the list. So that's why they're at number 10.
And I think that we actually had that in our best double bills of 2014. In fact, I believe I wrote that write-up. So,
and we are just on the same page.
Yeah.
And I know Nick really likes Nonstop.
I'm waiting for that to turn in at like number 2 for Nick.
It'll be mentioned.
I was going to say, we should mention that. Okay, so obviously all of our top 10s are published on the Film Stage. So if you'd like to read up, I mean, if you're, I don't know why you would listen to this and then read those or read those and then listen to this. Nick and Danny have both looked at mine. So none of my choices will be surprises to them. However, I did my damnedest not to look at theirs, even going so far as to avoid looking at the featured image that is used on their posts because I wanted to do this virgin.
You are in for a treat.
I am really looking forward to this. So, Nick Newman, what is your number 10 film?
Well, let me just say
I'm scared.
I have really nothing to say. Okay. I'll just say my number 10 film. My number 10 film is Monica Mana, which is a documentary by the Harvard Sensory Ethnography Lab, the people who were behind last year's Leviathan, which was very high on my list in 2013. And this is really quite a different film, whereas that was sort of this very grungy, explosive, assaultive piece of documentary filmmaking. This is
Leviathan, the fishing movie, not Leviathan, yes. The Russian movie.
Not the recent Russian drama that's been making some waves, which unfortunately... Well, why is that funny?
I don't know. It's just, never mind. You can cut that out.
I'd like to see that. That was one of the titles I was up for consideration, but I didn't actually get to see before making the list. Anyway, this from Stephanie Spray and Pancho Velez takes place entirely inside carts that take you from sort of this tourist attraction to the Monica Mana Temple in Nepal, which is a very holy place that it's believed that when you go there, you'll have any wish you make granted for making the trip. And one of the things that's often commented upon in the movie is that it used to take you something like 3 days. You had to hike through various terrain to get there. Now it takes a total of 11 minutes. And it just sits inside there, and it sits with each passenger as they go either to or from the Monica Mana Temple. And while this sounds like it could be incredibly boring, and to some people certainly will be, I found the experience of it sort of transcendent and calming and enlightening in sort of the way that I perceive, the way I absorb the cinematic image. Sitting there with these static shots for as long as I do, sort of ingesting each encounter as it comes. Sometimes they're very verbose, sometimes they're completely silent. One involves a bunch of goats that are traveling to and from there, or at least have been put on there. It has this sort of seamless quality to it, giving the illusion that it's all being done in one take, more or less. And I think that, you know, it kind of plays in the slow cinema realm a bit, but is in fact in fact, has this propulsion to it, because the whole time you're seeing the background shift as the cart is moving up and down. And as someone who's terrified of heights, I actually found it kind of exciting in a way, sitting there watching this happen. It's unlike anything else I've seen this year, just as Leviathan was unlike anything else I saw last year. And just like one of their first documentaries, Sweetgrass, was like unlike anything that came out in, I believe, 2010 or 2009. Regardless of the year, it's unlike anything that came out in that respective year. And it's a film that I really enjoyed a lot, and it kind of gets the 10 spot partly as a hat tip to sort of the effort. Some of the honorable mentions I have, I might like a little bit more, but this to me is kind of the most unique of anything on this list. So,
yeah, I went for a lot of the effort things too.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And thankfully it's on Netflix Watch Instantly. So.
Oh, excellent. Well, thank Nick for starting us off on a pretentious note, bringing us back. Danny started us off nice and populist, and Nick, true to form, ripped us back. I'm going to split the difference. My number 10 is the film Lock by director Stephen Knight, and starring Tom Hardy and the voices of a couple of other people. This is the movie that takes place entirely in a car. And this movie, for its formal daring, its excellent writing, the execution of this very strange idea so well, and Tom Hardy, just a magnetic presence. I mean, one of our best actors, and he's great in this, and I loved every second of it. I liked what it had to say about masculinity. I liked what it had to say about, what's that word I'm looking for? Taking responsibility and owning up to your mistakes, and kind of how the stoic, logical, prototypical male ideal of being able to overcome obstacles through sheer force of will might not actually be a thing. So, a lot to think about in that movie. Great time at the movies, and definitely worth a look. So that was my number 10. Now it's time for number 9. Danny.
Yo, Brian, guess what you think my number 9 is?
Is your number 9 Lock?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. That's good.
Yeah, I just really liked this movie when I saw it. And I think if I took the time to rewatch it, because it's been probably 5 or 6 months. I could maybe come up with some sort of approach that justifies why it works so well. It's actually funny, one critic that I really like, Jonathan Rosenbaum, who's usually sort of doesn't give much attention to new releases these days. He's a huge fan of this film, and he wrote a recent paragraph kind of reading it as a heroic existential Western. And I'm like, yeah, that's probably in there, and I could probably find that if I watched it again. But when I first saw it, it just was sort of like a clever idea that I think was executed almost seamlessly without really a false step. I know that the most awkward moments when I first watched it was the stuff when he's kind of talking to his dad through the rear view mirror. Mm-hmm. But even that stuff, I don't really mind in retrospect, because the performance is so good and so detailed. And yeah, I look forward to seeing it again sometime, because it's just a cool idea that's pulled off. The style is simple. It's not really overdone. And yeah, it's probably my favorite performance of the year. So, really good movie.
All right. Nick Newman, number 9.
At number 9, I didn't see Lock, by the way. I'm sorry to say. I'm sure I'd like it, and I wanted to see it, but I kind of forgot about it in the whole middle stretch of the year.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it came out at kind of a weird time.
Yeah.
Well, it came out during finals week for me. Oh. And then, basically, I left right after that.
Right.
So, I couldn't see it. Anyway. Moving on. Number 9 for me is the final film from one of my very favorite filmmakers, possibly my favorite filmmaker, maybe. It is Life of Riley by Alain René, who passed away right when we recorded our review of Nonstop. It all comes back to that. Passed away at the start of March. And so this is... I've never seen a film that is so difficult to remove from the context of its creator's existence or I suppose, lack thereof, because the whole film concerns these actors who are talking about an unknown, they're talking about an unseen collaborator of theirs who is discussed relentlessly, discussed positively and negatively. And these are all actors who have worked with Renee multiple times over, one of whom is actually his widow. And it is thus a very strange experience to watch this, knowing it's his final film, watching these actors talk about an unseen collaborator who they've worked with many times and they've had many experiences with. And so if I like it a bit more than I normally would because of that, so be it. That's how it is.
Okay.
I think it's, you know, a very fitting epilogue to his 2012-2013, depending on how you count it, film You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet, which was actually number 5 on my list last year. And just its ruminations on life and death and the way that we should celebrate the time we have on Earth and appreciate the people we know, I found very moving, both in sort of its simplicity and sincerity, in addition to this very complex orchestration of this very complex visual and oral orchestration, where the entire film sort of looks like it is taking place on some kind of strange forest setting. And the sound design of it is actually quite immaculate as well. I saw it at the Walter Reed Theater as part of the New York Film Festival and was kind of blown away by that, unexpectedly even. It's an incredibly funny film and, again, very heartfelt. I think it's a very nice send-off. It ends with perhaps the most definitive final scene a filmmaker could ever have and perhaps the most definitive final shot a filmmaker could ever have. And I was a big fan of it, but I think there's much to admire in it. And part of the reason, kind of like Monica Monica, there's a slightly political reasoning for putting this on my list because it didn't really get any distribution. It opened in basically one theater in New York City for about 10 days, and that's it. Despite it being picked up by Kino Lorber, who are usually pretty okay with these things.
Yeah.
But that means eventually it'll be on Netflix and you can get the DVD and Blu-ray when it's made available. It's a beautiful film, and I hope that people seek it out at some point.
All right. Well, sooner or later, Nick Newman is going to choose a movie that someone has heard of. Until that point, my number 9 is Interstellar by Christopher Nolan. This is a film that got a lot of weird backlash that I don't quite still understand. I feel like, yeah, it'd be easy to nitpick it. But the things it has to say about the power of human curiosity and love and just the way that those two powers can, and I know this is going to sound cheesy, but how they can like save us and how they're like our greatest asset in this deep dark void of nothingness that we float in, it's not something you see in movies a lot. And I loved the music, I loved the action set pieces, I loved the quieter moments. I thought that the actors all acquitted themselves well. You can listen to our full review on this because I had like a pretty impassioned monologue that I listened to. I just saw this again with my brother-in-law. And he, as the father of two young children, actually loved it, probably more than I did. And he gave us a lot to talk about afterwards. Yeah, it's a really fantastic film. And I feel like for some reason there's just like people might have the knives out for Nolan, and like maybe once like the furor around him dies down and people discover this movie externally down the road, it'll settle a little better. That's my hope anyway. So my number 9, Interstellar. And now it's time for Danny King's number 8 film of the year.
One thing I'll mention just before I mention my number 8, because it fits in, is that there were, I'm sure, like with you guys, that you've mentioned a lot of movies I didn't catch up with in time.
Did you see Interstellar?
No, I saw Interstellar. And I liked Interstellar, so that was a good pick.
Yeah, I was about to say, we talked about that, so if you're going to come clean right now and say, oh, I didn't get a chance to see that, we're going to have some words.
Guys, I didn't see Locke or Interstellar.
I only watched trailers this year.
Yeah, and I know Nick mentioned like last week or last time we recorded how he was planning to like squeeze in a lot of year-end titles right before this recording. But the first two films he mentioned, Monica Mana and Life of Riley, were two that I still haven't seen because for the past week, I've just been using iTunes gift cards I got to marathon old Clint Eastwood movies.
Okay.
Instead of catching up with new films. So, like, and I don't know what that says about my priorities, but my number eight film is American Sniper.
Oh, okay.
And this was one that I was hoping to watch again before making this list, because I came home, I saw the film in New York, and I came home for winter break, and I was sort of getting my parents really excited to see this film. And I remember
it wasn't out until the next.
Yeah. So like, you're getting all these commercials for it, and I'm like, all right, we'll see it this weekend. And then, you know, I find out it's not going to open here for another 2 weeks or three weeks.
That's what happened with my brother-in-law and I. Like, he texted me a while ago. He's like, so the day after Christmas, American Sniper. I was like, fuck yeah. And then like, we got down there. I'm like, all right, let's look up times. I was in Houston. I was like, what the
fuck? Yeah.
Come on, guys.
I'm kind of surprised too.
Yeah, they did the same thing last year with Lone Survivor.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, it was out random places on Christmas, and then the middle of January, they're like, all right, now the rest of you can have it. And then the year before that, I think it was Zero Dark Thirty.
It's just unfortunate.
Yeah, it's really fucked up.
All
of our American military films are being withheld from Americans.
Yeah. Well, you know, this one, it'll be out eventually, and I will see it again. But I just said sort of like, fuck it, I'll put it on my list because I've been thinking about it a lot. And yeah, I think few things this year have left me sort of as riveted as the scenes in this movie where Bradley Cooper's behind his rifle and the camera's kind of pushing in on him as he has to kind of just consider the weight of the things he's doing. And I think the movie, you know, it's been getting in some circles slammed for maybe its jingoistic quality, but I think it's actually an incredibly balanced portrait that is both sort of attesting to the authenticity of this character's values, but also very disturbed by them. And I think in the end it is pretty balanced. And it's also, if we're talking about material that's well matched for Eastwood, this is a film that is about a born and bred American cowboy that's nicknamed the Legend, so it's just sort of like right up his alley of American myths and American masculinity. And yeah, I look forward to seeing it again. And it's also funny that the film stage has two other top 10 lists that have Jersey Boys, so
which is surprising.
Yeah, so I feel like we're sort of sticking up for Clint here, and I'm happy to.
Did Nonstop get a lot of other love? I saw it on, I think it was LaBouza's honorable mention.
Honorable mention, yeah.
Nonstop, man. It's a damn good film.
Gotta stick up for this stuff.
And you'll just have to wait for when I keep counting down.
Yeah, I'm, like I said, number two. Can we make a bet? Like, can I make a bet with you? And if I do, like, the Price is Right thing, where I'm the closest without going over, I get something?
It depends what you want.
Okay, you know what? Fuck it. I'm just gonna, just for a personal, I'm going to say that you probably put Nonstop at number five.
Okay.
Well, I'm going to split the difference, so we'll keep an eye out for that.
All right.
For now, however, give us your number eight pick.
My number eight film is a film about complicated men and tortured women and questions of what it means to really express yourself and how to treat other people. Told with beautiful cinematography, erudite writing, excellent direction,
listen up, fucking Philip.
Wonderful performances, and a strong score. It is Listen Up, Philip.
God damn it.
The third feature from writer-director Alex Rosperi, who previously made the excellent The Color Wheel, and also Implex, which is a good film, too.
The Color Wheel?
And
Excretable?
What else is there to say?
Literally nothing.
That has not been said on a podcast before, except that this is a film that holds up to multiple viewings. I'm happy to say that the Tribeca films
of watching it.
I was writing up my top 10 list last night, I loaded the Tribeca film screener that was sent to me and had it on in the background, and you can just listen to it like music. But that would be a disservice to the excellent visual palette of this film. An accomplished one, a very accomplished one. I'm a big fan of Listen Up, Philip. It is number eight on my list.
I will say.
Thank you.
I will say, at least it's not higher. That's all. My number eight film is also about complicated men and tortured women and struggling ambition. I don't know. It's not going to surprise you. You've both already read my damn list. But for the people at home, this is Nightcrawler starring Jake Gyllenhaal.
Oh, you're going to give me shit for ranking lists on Philip, and then you put Nightcrawler. Oh.
Anyway, no, Nightcrawler, no. Also beautifully photographed. And I don't remember the score, so I can't say that with any earnestness. But Nightcrawler, anchored by a wonderful Jake Gyllenhaal performance, has some of the best pure dialogue scenes that I've seen this year. Jake Gyllenhaal delivers numerous soliloquies with just this weird mixture of like earnestness and fury. And you're like entranced by him, but just he's like Jordan Belfort without the ability to mask his ugliness. So yeah, Nightcrawler. On top of that, it's also just a tense, thrilling, fun movie. Nightcrawler. Now we're down to lucky number 7. Danny King, why don't you kick us off?
My number 7 is lucky number 11.
God damn it.
My number 7 is David Fincher's 7.
I hate you. 7 Brides for 7 Brothers.
My number 7 film.
Magnificent 7.
Is 2 Days, 1 Night.
Oh, okay.
Which isn't sort of as visceral as some of the Dardenne Brothers' earlier work. There aren't that many close-ups from what I can recall. It's sort of observes Marion Cotillard from a distance a little bit, but that doesn't negate the emotional identification that happens. It's a really wrenching film. It's just kind of a cycle of phone calls and arguments and naps and pills, and she gives a really great performance, but by the end of it, it really just kind of builds to an overwhelming emotional effect, like all of their great films. And so, yeah, maybe we'll get to talk about it more at some point. But
it's, I certainly hope so.
Yeah, it's the first of 2 Cotillard films that I'll be talking about. Not really a spoiler if you've been following my opinion of movies this year.
Oh, okay. Never mind. I was about to. You'll understand why I now think that I'm an idiot in just a second.
Okay.
But Nick Newman, what is your number 7 pick?
My number 7 pick is a film by the title of Close Curtain, which is the latest, which is the second feature from Jafar Panahi that has been made while under his 20-year filmmaking ban. For those who don't,
A really effective ban then.
No, not really. But for those who don't know, Jafar Panahi is a Iranian filmmaker who is of great influence. For reference, he has worked multiple times with Abbas Kiarostami and has made a number of features that were very influential in his country's cinematic climate before he was arrested for supposedly attempting to make a film about the controversial 2009 elections. And following 2012's This Is Not a Film, which was on my 2012 list, as a matter of fact, we have Close Curtain, which he co-directed with Kambuzia Partavi. My apologies to him if I mispronounced that, but he's almost certainly not listening to this. It starts as a very intimate chamber drama, basically, involving a writer who goes to this home and puts black curtains over the windows and puts the lights on and essentially makes this very cozy environment for him where he can work until these people come in and sort of intrude on his solitary life. And then somehow, some way, Jafar Panahi himself enters the film as its central dramatic figure. In my little write-up on it, I wrote a very pretentious first sentence that I'm going to read here. I said, images within images, narratives within narratives, images as a means of advancing narrative, narrative as a means of undercutting the perceived truth of an image. And it's a very naughty film. Naughty as in...
K-N-O-T.
It's quite naughty.
Yeah.
I was about to say, well, now you have my interest.
Yeah. Only soon will you find out what goes on behind the closed curtain.
Yeah.
But otherwise...
open up that curtain, baby.
it's a very, I mean, I found the film intensely moving as a fan of Panahi, and to see the sort of the desolate emotional state he's been left in. A lot of the film concerns the rumination on suicide, And it is troubling to see him in this state, and yet it is resulting in such a beautiful work of art that I think is a very valuable statement on what it means to express yourself as an artist and what it means to bring your art into the world, to have your voice heard, and what happens when you can't be heard anymore. It's a movie that moved me intensely, and I am hoping that it will get a bit more attention soon enough. In January, you'll actually be able to buy $13, and then I'm sure it'll go somewhere else because it was released by Amplify, who were a decent-sized company. Hmm. I mean, you know, they're kind of a startup, but they're a decent-sized company. Although it is a very sort of mysterious film, a movie that doesn't have really a clear set of answers, I actually compared it to Last Year at Marion Bad when I was talking to somebody. Hmm. I think it's actually quite similar to that. It has an emotional core that's so crystal clear that the mysteries of it never need to be solved for me because I got everything from it that I needed to get. And it's a movie that I'm going to go back to over the years and kind of keep inspecting. It's a really beautiful movie. And honestly, I feel like I would rank it higher if I had seen it more than 2 weeks ago because it has not left me in the time since. So Close Curtain by Panahi and Partovi. It is beautiful.
All right. So this is why I was laughing earlier. Danny King said it's one of two Marion Cotillard films that he's going to have on his list. And I'm sitting there staring at my computer screen going, what? What else is Marion Cotillard in? My number seven film, The Immigrant.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I was like, what? What could he possibly be talking about? I was like...
Inception?
I was like, it's not Inception. It's not The Dark Knight Rises. Like... Rust and Bone? That wasn't this year. Somehow, it escaped me that I had exactly what you're talking about. The Immigrant. An old school kind of old Hollywood tale told with a old Hollywood style that still manages to find a vein of modernity. And just beautiful performance by Cotillard, really nailing down the kind of role that... what's her name? Joan Crawford would probably have filled in back in the day. And, I mean, Joaquin Phoenix, gotta love the guy. He does a really, really fantastic job in this. And I just love the way it evokes this time and this place and really puts you in the shoes of this woman and doesn't ask you to pity her. It asks you rather to root for her, which is something that a lot of these films and a lot of films of this type don't understand. The difference between. So The Immigrant, a person who is buffeted by circumstance, but certainly not controlled by it. It's on Netflix Instant, I'm pretty sure, so definitely check it out because it did not get enough love previously. Number six, Danny King.
Yeah, Immigrant, really good stuff.
Is that your number six?
Nah.
Oh, okay.
Number six is Boyhood.
All right.
And this is a film that I've sort of had a tough time sitting with since I saw it. It's probably been like 6 months, and I really liked it. And I've always been meaning to see it again, but I haven't been able to do it yet. And I don't know if this is just me, but one of the weird things about responding to it is that a lot of my friends don't like it. Yeah, and it's this like weird...
They shouldn't be your fucking friends, Dan. Why are you hanging out with those people?
It's just like this weird film within my like group of college friends that most of them just agree is like way overrated. Oh. And so just being around that for like 6 months has really confused me. But then the other day, one of my favorite critics, Ben Sachs, who writes for the Chicago Reader, he wrote something that kind of brought the feeling back to me of why I love this movie when I first saw it. So I'm just going to read part of that. He writes, "The movie regards every character, no matter how minor, with the same poker-faced curiosity, suggesting that anyone we see could have a transformative effect on the protagonist, or that maybe everyone's equally trivial in the scheme of things. When Patricia Arquette tearfully confesses in her wrenching final scene, I just thought there'd be more. She's really stating the movie's theme. And I think that's key, especially because what really devastated me when I saw it was this two-sided arc of Patricia Arquette's character becoming increasingly sort of disillusioned as her son becomes increasingly confident and sort of self-assured. And it's this really sad, kind of honest arc that just happens in life. And I think that's kind of an observation that I haven't seen portrayed in many other movies. And that's sort of the feeling that it left me with when I first saw it. So probably just reading that observation bumped this movie up on my list, because it just leaves me kind of shaken. So yeah, that's my number six.
All right, Nick Newman, number six.
Well, I was going to make the sound of an orchestra playing, but if you have seen the movie, you probably still wouldn't get it because my impersonation would be so bad. B, if you haven't, you have no idea what I'm doing. So anyway, number six is Goodbye to Language by Jean-Luc Godard, which I'm pretty sure would end up on this list in some position if it was just the greatest technical achievement I experienced this year. It's rare I see a film that contains shots which I have no real concept of, i.e. how they were conceived and executed, how they actually exist inside the film itself. This features multiple of those. It is among the best 3D I've ever encountered. And in addition to that, I found there to be a very affecting story of sort of emotional deadening and the dissolution of ideas, and the idea that art perhaps doesn't have nearly as much worth as we like to think. Which is interesting coming from Godard, you know, now at 84, who is still finding ways to sort of, you know, revolutionize various forms of cinema as a medium. And it's not a movie I would for one second pretend to understand all of, but I found the experience of it very deeply affecting in sort of the emotional current that it is operating on. And I mean, if it was, again, if it was just for the shots where, the 3D shots where the image separates into two, one image moves while another image remains static, and then the image rejoins itself, which is even crazier than it sounds when I'm saying it, all in 3D. If it was just for that, I think it would deserve a placement, but I think it's also a deeply affecting, beautiful film. This is probably my favorite of the late Godard films, at least was probably started since, like, In Praise of Love, or something. Like, yeah, probably In Praise of Love is where it started. This is my favorite of them. And apparently he's working on a new film now. Part of me, although I greatly anticipate it, part of me hopes he doesn't have another one. I would love for this to just be his last statement. To end in particular on the shot that this film ends on is so hilarious. This movie is hilarious, in addition to being very, very deeply felt and really quite sad. So Goodbye to Language is a really great time. Hopefully it'll come around to your city if you haven't seen it yet, because it got a slightly smaller distribution than was necessary. Some theaters don't want to book a 3D art film, weirdly enough. But there it is. That is my number six.
All right. Well, for my number six, I am going with a strange, beautiful, brutal, very weird film. I'm going with Snowpiercer.
Oh, good choice.
Thank you. This is Bong Joon-ho's film about the last remnants of humanity living in a train that is speeding endlessly around the world, and Chris Evans as the leader of a rebellion hoping to take over the train because, wow, have conditions really gotten bad for the poor. Like, really bad, guys. This is a stark, brutal, no holds barred, really messed up, awesome film. I still get chills when a door opens to reveal a particularly treacherous room, and a scene involving a fish continues to haunt my nightmares. And yeah, it's like by turns, like, slapstick funny and also like viscerally violent. And I think it says something really interesting and strange about how the mechanics of nature and of, like, the laws that govern machinery, humanity has kind of shaken off. but to our detriment should our good fortune ever go down the tubes. This is almost a complete and utter... It's like the antithesis of Interstellar. Because whereas Interstellar says, if faced with a problem, mankind would persevere and create and reach out through love and curiosity to find an answer, this is a movie that says we would turn on each other like a pack of rabid animals and begin losing our inherent humanity that, like, plenty has given us, and instead revert to a system wherein we use and abuse each other just because we need to. They both make a convincing argument. I'd like to think that Interstellar's is the correct one, but this gets a little bit higher, I think, just because it's leaner and it's a little less uneven in places, and because, I don't know, in all honesty, the way that a lot of these numbers shook out just was kind of how I was feeling at the time that I compiled this list. So yeah, Snowpiercer. Damn good film. And it's got our girl Tilda in it. I'm surprised we haven't spoken about any of her movies yet.
Oh, Zero Theorem's my number one.
Oh, well, thank God for that. I was going to say, I'm sure that as we get closer to the top, she will appear somewhere else in someone else's list. So, Snowpiercer, number six. So we're at the halfway point. I couldn't think of anything clever to say. So let's just do it. Danny King, your number five pick for best film of the year. Your pick for the fifth best film of the year.
I'm sorry, what am I saying here?
I don't know, just throw one out there.
My number five is a French drama called Jealousy, directed by a man named Philippe Garrel. Okay. It's a 77-minute black and white film about relationships. And it's sort of a movie I like to put pretty high on my list because the more movies I see, the less sort of stock I put in kind of like surface level ambition. So just to like make a comparison that isn't really justified, anything in Birdman or Interstellar is not more exciting than some of the tracking shots in this small 77-minute movie where Louis Garrel, the director's son, and the lead actress are walking together in the park and just watching their body language, the way their bodies sort of collide or wrapping their arms around each other when they're happy or doing the opposite when they're fighting. Stuff like that to me is just as kind of amazing as, you know, the black hole in Interstellar. And it's the same thing sort of with the Dardenne's work. Just the specificity of human behavior that they capture. Jealousy, for instance, opens with a scene where a little girl is watching her parents break up through a keyhole. And it's almost like something out of a silent film where a character's viewing something through a doorway, and it's just amazing. And my sort of evaluation of this movie is a little bit hampered by the fact that it's the only Garrel film I've seen. So, you know, how I worded it in my write-up is that if I'd seen more, this could either be my number one or my number 10. But either way, it was a great first kind of film to be introduced to him, and I look forward to seeing more.
All right. Nick Newman.
Okay. Well, number is Stranger by the Lake from Alain Girardi.
Sure, let's, why not?
Yeah. this is a real strange beast of a film. It is by far the most graphic title on my list. It features several scenes of possibly unsimulated sex. I mean, it has, you know, moments, it has shots that I cannot for the life of me imagine how they could have gone unsimulated considering what I'm seeing. But it concerns sort of this gay cruising spot on a beach in France, and this guy named Frank, who shows up there every day and, you know, cruises for some action, And while he's there, he sees this very handsome mustachioed man named Michel commit a murder. And as he sort of goes back and keeps cruising, he forms a relationship with this guy, a very passionate, sort of overwhelmingly physical relationship. And it is a really tense, really exciting thriller that, in addition to being really quite sexy, and I say this as a heterosexual male, even watching this, I was like, oh, baby, this is quite a lot. In addition to all of those things, I mean, it is so tightly controlled. It has such a consistent formal dressing to it that as soon as I saw it, I thought, there's no way this isn't going to end up somewhere on my list, kind of like Go By the Language in that sense. It rose to the top half, really, I think, just over time, considering how neatly delineated every piece of action. I didn't mean to word it that way. Every narrative incident, let's say, is deployed. It's an incredibly fun movie, in addition to also being, again, a very kind of sexy, very scary piece of work. A very, I think, convincing portrayal of obsession and knowing that you're making a terrible mistake, but still kind of falling further and further into it because of the passion that is involved. There are cum shots in this movie, if you guys are interested.
I mean, well, yeah, obviously, who wouldn't be?
Yeah. So, Stranger by the Lake, it's on Netflix Watch instantly. So I would recommend watching it. Just be conscious of two things. One, if there's anybody in the house while you're watching it. Two, who you're sharing the account with. I actually got kind of fortunate because I watched this on sort of like the family account. And I think I watched it like the 22nd or the 23rd, which means that a bunch of Christmas movies started to be streamed like the next day. So it kind of got buried.
So like your parents aren't going to get like, because you enjoyed Stranger by the Lake.
Well, they might. I'm curious to see what I would recommend to them.
Perfect.
But yeah, Stranger by the Lake, it's a really beautiful movie. And it kind of hits a, no pun intended, sweet spot for me. So there you have it.
Okay, well, my number five is, I mean, I usually try to, like, come up with some kind of segue. I was going to say something about fabulous mustaches, but that just seems really reductive. Anyway, my number five is The Grand Budapest Hotel. This is a
controversial choice.
Is it?
No.
This is another Tilda Swinton movie.
By the time the film hits its top 50 posts, which should be something like a day or two after this recording, you'll see that it is very much not a controversial choice.
That's why I was going to say, I feel like I'm kind of okay with this one. The Grand Budapest Hotel, a beautiful, well-constructed film, brilliantly acted by Ralph Fiennes, not Ralph Fiennes. Are we sure he's right about that? I really don't understand his fucking name. It doesn't matter. He's brilliant in this film. He instills a lot of layers into a character who, in the hands of a lesser actor, could have come off as one-note or schizophrenic. And in general, the movie is just glorious to look at. And it actually is like an angry countermand to all of the bad things that have ever been said about Wes Anderson. And perfectly backs up all the good things that I've always said about Wes Anderson. So, hooray, Grand Budapest Hotel. This is my number five. It almost could have gotten higher if it weren't for the fact that some of the films that are coming next are movies that I think put a little more effort in, because this doesn't feel like Wes Anderson really leaving his wheelhouse. So I felt like I wanted to really burnish films that I felt were going for something new, something daring. So keep that in mind as we move forward. I love The Grand Budapest Hotel. I've seen it like 3 or 4 times. Yeah, Grand Budapest Hotel, number five for me. That brings us to number four, Danny King.
Wow, we're getting close.
We're getting close, guys. We're in top five territory. I guess I could have said that when we started the number five, but I didn't. So now we're in top four territory.
Yeah, just to say one more thing about Stranger by the Lake. I saw that film like over a year ago, and it's the direction is almost like perfect. But I wondered when I first saw it if it sort of kind of transcended the kind of genre quality of the material, or just sort of the provocation factor, but I think if there's one thing that starting my list off with two Liam Neeson movies proves, it's that I no longer really care about movies just being genre movies or kind of just communicating simple ideas. So I think if I had rewatched that film, that might have popped up somewhere on my list, because it is, I mean, it's been, like I said, so long since I've seen it, and I still remember it quite vividly. Maybe just because it's so explicit, I don't know, but that is a pretty great film, and it's good that it's on Netflix. My number four is, I believe, a film that was on Nick's list last year. This is Stray Dogs. Yeah.
What was that noise?
By the Taiwanese director Tsai Ming-wang. And I actually had to review this movie, so I unfortunately watched it on like a Vimeo link rather than seeing it in a theater, which is just unfortunate because it's such a cinematic work with incredibly long takes and agonizing emotion. But it's just one of the most overwhelming experiences of the year, and I look forward to seeing more Tsai films. I have a link to my review on my write-up, so you can check that out for some more thoughts.
All right. Nick Newman, number four. Wait a second. I just realized I said that Nonstop would be your number five.
Ah.
And we have now eclipsed the number five and are now on to number four, and we still haven't heard about Nonstop. Nick, Where the fuck is Nonstop? Anyway,
a mystery that only Detective Neeson... I don't remember the character's name in that movie.
Drunk Neeson.
Drunk Neeson.
Drunk Flying Neeson.
A mystery that only he can solve. And I think if he's clever enough, I'll have dropped a couple of hints.
It was something a little nutty, wasn't it, his name in that? It was like a preposterous movie character name.
Let's pause here.
Bill Marks.
All right.
Detective William Marks.
That's
or I guess it was Marshall.
All right. Well, it's time to go to number four. My number four is also a film directed by Tsai Ming-wang, but not Stray Dogs. My number four is Journey to the West, which is the title I spoke of at the beginning, the one I'm making a slight exception for, and that's because it premiered this year, and it was not actually released in theaters in the United States, but it was made available online for something like a week in the spring. And I figured, you know what? It is good enough to land on my list. It is an exceptional piece of film craft. It technically counts. I'm not going to push it to next year. Let's put it on here. So anyway, it's the shortest film on my list. It's the shortest film on any of these lists because it's only about 54 minutes long, and something like 8 minutes of it consists solely of a close-up shot of Denis Levant's face, which is kind of a sight to behold. So, looks like, and I assume you do if you're listening to this show, you stare at that face for something like 8 minutes, and then the film begins. Really, it's an exemplary piece of slow cinema filmmaking, much like Stray Dogs. Although it's a lot more fun, which isn't really saying much. Stray Dogs is not fun at all, but but it's more fun than Sallow. But I mean, otherwise, but no. It's a very amusing film because basically the setup is Li Kangsheng, who is Tsai Ming-wang's muse, his favorite actor, wears a monk's robe and walks at a pace that is essentially as slow as any human being could walk without not moving while still mobile. And he walks through these metropolitan spaces very slowly as people observe him and wonder exactly what the hell he is doing. And in the film, Denis Levant plays a person of some sort who is shadowing this monk and following him while walking extremely slow. In my write-up, I described it as a tortoise and the tortoise race, and also kind of something of a sort of like a game of Where's Waldo, basically, because there are these wide shots of a cityscape where you want to figure out where exactly this monk is walking really, really slowly, and eventually you actually figure out where he is. Sometimes there are shots that will go on for like a minute before you realize exactly where he is inside the frame. That's how visually dense this movie is. I don't know if there's much of a deeper meaning to it, except that I think that it is a fascinating example of the narrative documentary hybrid. It's kind of a stealth example of that because it doesn't announce itself as being as much, and yet it's a fun game to watch other people in the movie stare at this guy and basically go, what the fuck is he doing? Because he's just walking in the space really, really slowly. And it's so funny. But it's also kind of moving, too, because he's so committed to doing this. And it must be physically exhausting to keep up this thing where you have your foot in the air for something like 30 seconds at a time, taking step by step by step. And has a deeper meaning, I'm not sure what, but it is probably the most visually astonishing thing, other than Goodbye to Language, the most visually astonishing 2D thing I saw this year, and probably the one that's most visually dense. I had a really great time with Journey to the West. It'll be available on the Stray Dogs Blu-ray that's coming out in February, so if you want to have a wacky double feature, as I said, it's kind of like, it's sort of
have
like
some
the art
friends
house.
Over.
Have some friends over. It's kind of like the art house version of Nonstop and A Walk Among the Tombstones.
Yeah, I think so.
Had I seen Stray Dogs this year, I might have actually done a little double feature of the two. It's like an interesting point counterpoint. One is extremely dark. One is very kind of fun and expressive. So Journey to the West is my number four.
Where the fuck is Nonstop? This is driving me nuts. And if you lied and it's not on this list somewhere, I'm going to be angry. Anyway. My number four is about an alien who is running around Scotland, abducting men and sucking their organs and bones and everything else out from their skin. It is definitely not the kind of movie that you would think I'm describing based on that explanation. It is Under the Skin. It is a slow burn, interesting, strangely constructed, strangely shot, really, really heady, beautiful film. Scarlett Johansson continues to prove people wrong who thought that she was just a pretty face and a nice body, something that I have known for years, and I'm glad that the rest of the world is catching up. So, Under the Skin by Jonathan Glazer. This film, I believe, is free to stream on Amazon Prime. So check that shit out, because, I mean, you're not going to see another film like this. And it is just something else. There are images, not even like plot important images, but images in this nonetheless that have not left me since I saw it. Under the Skin, my number four. Top three time, guys. I keep trying to come up with like a stupid, dumb analogy that could possibly make our listeners laugh, and it's really not working for me. I was going to be like, if you were stuck in a four-person boat, you could only fit three of these movies in there with you, but that's not clever. So anyway, fuck it, let's continue to be lazy. Number three, Danny, what is your third most favorite film of this year?
Well, I will just say quickly that Under the Skin is sort of one of those films I sacrifice to make room for my Liam double bill. But if I had put it on my top 10, I probably would have done, and I had been thinking about this, I probably would have done a double bill with Lucy. Did either of you see Lucy?
No, I didn't.
No, okay. Unfortunately, I wanted to.
I think it's a good movie. I think Under the Skin is a better film, but Lucy has the one scene that I think is Scarlett Johansson's best scene. So that's why I would have put it on the list. It's the scene where she, I won't spoil it, but I just, so that listeners know which one I'm talking about. It's like she makes a phone call to her mom, and it's the scene that takes place in close up with her on the phone, and just the range of emotions that she goes through is incredible. So shout out for Lucy. But it didn't make my list. My number three film, which I'm going to be very brief about so as to not start a riot,
is Listen Up, Philip. I swear to God. I swear to God, all of you. It's fine.
Yeah.
It's fine. It's fine.
And I remember not even saying that much about it when we recorded on it, because I was too
scared.
I was too floored by Brian's rage.
Which I did a decent job of holding back. I did not have to get an editorial note regarding my cursing on
No editorial notes?
No.
Okay.
No.
I've
neglected to listen to that episode again, though, because I'm just afraid to hear myself. Because I went into a fugue state and I have no idea what I said.
Yeah, it was shocking.
I'm glad.
But yeah, I really like the movie. I linked to a long piece I wrote on it that, for the moment, contains most of my thoughts. So you can find that on this site.
Okay. Excellent. Excellent. Great. Perfect. Fantastic. Nick Newman, what is your bronze medal film of the year?
Bronze medal.
Bronze medal.
I did not think of this as a bronze medal picture when I assigned it. I didn't think of gold, silver, bronze, tin, anything like that. I guess, does bronze have kind of like an ageless quality?
Yeah, you know, it's like Bronze Age. You think about Roman shit, and oftentimes you probably think of something bronze. Sure, yeah, that works.
Okay, well, I suppose it's appropriate enough because my number three film is...
Nonstop.
Jim Jarmusch's Only Lovers Left Alive.
God damn it.
Jim Jarmusch's Nonstop.
I would kill to see that shit happen.
Oh, boy.
Just like... Okay, so, yeah, that would be great. I want to, like, start a thing where, you know how, like, people remake movies? I want to get authors to rewrite books. Mm-hmm. So I want to, like, buy the rights to Lord of the Rings and then have Cormac McCarthy write it. Stick to the story structure, but, like, put his own spin on it. I don't know why Jim Jarmusch's Nonstop made me think of that, but it would be great. And if anyone out there is rich and famous and has Cormac McCarthy's ear, give me a call, because we can make that happen.
All right.
Anyway, Only Lovers Left Alive.
Only Lovers Left Alive, a movie I saw in mid-April when it came out and has stayed with me ever since. To revisit it, honestly, even though I've been told that it holds up incredibly well through second viewing and benefits from just sort of having around as a movie you can put on, I haven't felt much need to revisit it because I felt so strongly in my convictions of loving it when I saw it. And I still feel the same way. I think it is... I think when we reviewed it, I said that to me it is in some sense a perfect film. It doesn't necessarily mean flawless, because I suppose no film is really flawless, but...
But of course, of course.
What?
I said, but of course. Nah.
But of course. it's a kind of movie that I suppose, as I said in my write-up, I feel like would not, on papers, in my own words, were an absolute fucking nightmare, just because you take... As I said, a climate of daily takedowns, contrarian posturing, cries of yearning for decades past, and ruminations on what it all really means, filtered through probably the most tired conceit in all of popular culture, I suppose next to only zombies. Putting those two together to me sounds awful, sounds absolutely terrible, and yet I think that the pairing of Jarmusch and vampires, particularly vampires who are cranky about culture, is a really wonderful pairing, but I don't think it's a totally judgmental film. I don't think it is proclaiming superiority above anything necessarily. I think a lot of times the joke is on these people, in sort of how time has made them shallow and has made them nearsighted in a lot of ways. Again, wanting things
it's
to
a lot
be
like It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia that way.
Okay. Both take place in terrible American cities.
Yes.
That's true. Anyway, I lost my train of thought. Thanks, Brian.
You're welcome.
But
number two.
It also, I mean, it's a movie that I think kind of lays its ground fairly neatly in its opening moments when it equates a spinning record with a spinning shot of the main characters lying down. I think the movie kind of neatly sets up a number of thematic through lines in that one shot. And if it seems very blunt, I also think it is very elegant at the same time, which is how really I take a lot of the film to be blunt, but elegant. It's just such a pleasure of a movie, something I can kind of wallow in and sit with, you know, it's a movie that has kind of marinated for me in a lot of ways. And it's a great time. So Only Lovers Left Alive earns a high spot on my list.
Yeah, I think I've become kinder to this movie since we talked about it. I didn't hate it, obviously. But yeah, I'll agree with you. Letting it marinate. I still think back fondly on certain aspects of it. But that's unimportant. Number three for me, my bronze medal, Boyhood, filmed by Richard Linklater, starring Ellar Coltrane, Ethan Hawke, Patricia Arquette. This, what is there to say about this film that hasn't already been said a million times? It's great. It's beautiful. It made me sad, made me happy. It made me realize the transitive nature of time. Gave me a small existential crisis. Anyway, Boyhood, it's a great film. It's just really, really good. And I'll just say that it's a movie that has a gimmick, but it denies that gimmick so much, the way that like it doesn't announce when the cuts in time have happened, that it becomes this even flow of moments. And it's really masterful and marvelous. And this and Under the Skin, with its, you know, camera technology in the car, are definitely two films that boosted up a little higher just because of the great formal balls that these people had to have to really pull these things off. And I think they deserved a little extra shout for that. And now, here we come.
Hey, Brian.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you a little shout out.
I was really hoping it was going to be the song that's in the trailer, but I guess that was too much to hope for.
I can sing that.
No, it's fine. It's fine. I'll cut it in post. So here we are, number two films of the year for us. One away from number one. Very, very good. Not quite as good as number one, but the odd thing is that people will still probably be the most impatient with our number two, because they're all wondering what our number one was. So I'm going to drag out this introduction just a little longer, just to really turn the screws on you assholes. Anyway, Danny King, why don't you tell us what your first loser for the year was?
First loser, terrible
first loser.
Film.
Number
here it
two,
is.
First loser. What is it?
Big time failure.
Yep.
Yeah, this is going to be a little bit anticlimactic.
Oh, damn it. Is it Grand Budapest?
The film is The Grand Budapest Hotel. And my only issue with it is that I saw it 9 months ago.
That's not its fault.
And I didn't write about it at the time, so I don't know what to say about it.
It's on HBO Go. We can take a break.
should we do that?
No, it's fine.
Do
you just want to second everything that I said?
I will second everything you said. I really loved the movie. And, you know, I wish I had seen it more recently.
Sweet. I hope we have a little more to say about the first, but you're really helping out the people who just want to get to the end. Nick Newman, what is your always a bridesmaid, never a bride choice for your film?
Well, the lead character of my number two film would probably never want to be a bride, let alone a bridesmaid.
Oh my God, is it Liam Neeson in Nonstop? Is it Air Marshal Bill Marks?
It is actually, God damn it, this, no, it's not, I'm sorry.
Okay,
it is,
if Nonstop isn't your goddamn number one choice, I'm gonna fucking kill you.
My number two choice is Roman Polanski's Venus in Fur.
Ooh,
yes. which is a movie that did not appear on a single other film stage top 10 list.
Well, look at
which,
you.
I'm shocked.
Which I was kind of surprised by, honestly, because I think this is a wonderful, exciting, sexy, dangerous film that has, I think, great appeal past just being an exemplary piece of film craft. It came out in something like May or June, I think, and was given a slightly limited release, but I was able to see it when it came out and was second place choice, because I suppose a number of the films that have come before it are of greater ambition and perhaps a greater accomplishment as well, but this is the one that kind of, like what will be my number one choice, kind of hit each mark so decisively
each
and so confidently.
Bill Marks?
It's a nonstop example of cinematic craft. It hit each mark so confidently, so decisively, so definitively, and did so without, I think, being terribly ostentatious about it. In my write-up, I said that this movie couldn't be more cinematic if it relied on elaborate sets and crazy camera swoops. It is two people, Matthew Amalric, and who is a Polanski doppelganger, if ever there was one, and Polanski's wife, Emmanuelle Seigneur, on a stage together, rehearsing a play that pretty much anybody could realize is a direct corollary to the drama itself between these two characters. Mm-hmm. And it's a film that milks every single gesture and facial expression and cut and angle for its maximum effect, and is deeply, deeply funny while also being, a great example of Polanski's sort of close quarter combat style of filmmaking, this intellectual and physical game of one-upsmanship, featuring, some very sort of scintillating sexual...
Scintillating?
Scintillating,
now,
sure.
Did you say that because you wanted to make a portmanteau of scintillating and skin? Or do you not know how to pronounce scintillating?
No, I absolutely wanted to make a portmanteau.
Okay.
Obviously.
I mean, you say obviously, but you have been known to fuck up some weird words every now and then. Like candelabra.
No.
Candelabra.
Obviously, this is what I wanted to do.
Okay. Just making sure. Just want to be sure.
So, scintillating sexual play going on here. I really, really love this film. I think as someone who is a huge Polanski acolyte, filmmaker, not person, let's just be clear.
I base all of my life choices around things that he's done.
Yes.
Yeah.
As someone who has expressed a love for Polanski in the past, maybe ultimately this isn't a huge surprise, but considering we never reviewed it, and I don't think I've ever actually mentioned it by name on the show.
Yeah, I 100% forgot this happened this year.
Okay.
You brought it up in your most look forward to or something. I know I've heard you speak about your desire to see it. I don't think I even know that you had.
Yeah, possibly. So it's a fantastic movie. And again, on Netflix, watch instantly. So it is right there. I think it's something like, I don't know, it's like 100 minutes. It's so briskly paced and so carefully paced too, that slipping into it, I think, is just a great pleasure. And it's one that I'll go back to over the years just to kind of sit with, kind of like Only Lovers Left Alive, although I wouldn't, it's probably where I'd stop the comparisons for most respects, but okay. In most respects, but anyway, Venus and Fur.
All right. Well, my second place film is Ida, the black and white Polish film from Paweł Pawlikowski. We talked about this a lot when we actually talked about it on this show, if you can parse that sentence, that terribly constructed sentence, in case anyone ever accuses us of writing a script for this show, obviously not the case. But yeah, Ida, I wrote about this having some of the best cinematography on one of our year-end lists. I talked at length about my love for this film when we podcasted about it earlier. And it has remained one of the films that I think about and return to and really admire the most. It looks at personal, religious, political things, but doesn't really come at them with the kind of agenda that you expect a film like this to have. It's really an exploration in the truest sense of the word. And I love the way that it allows its character to its two characters to do things and say things and believe things and feel things and not judge them from the point of view of one of the others. And I think that a lot of that is seen in a visual sense from the extreme amount of space that is left above the heads of these characters, creating kind of a liminal spiritual space for these people. So Ida, it's goddamn gorgeous, and it's really quite moving. And it's only like 89 minutes, too, if even that much. It's a very short film. Ida, check it out. I guess I could say Ida, because I don't want people typing a bunch of E's into Google when they're looking for this, but it is pronounced Ida. Anyway, that brings us, at long last, to our number one films.
Wow.
Of the year 2014, Anno Domini. Danny King,
wow.
Are you ready to tell us what your number one film of the year is?
Wow.
Are you? Is it? Are you ready?
I don't think I am.
Do you need some time?
I'll just do it, I guess.
You just got to rip it off, man. It's like a Band-Aid.
Okay.
It's like, I don't know, like a Band-Aid. Band-Aid's a good analogy.
The number one film is The Immigrant.
Woo!
And what I did for my write-up is just list four moments in this film. One of them is when Cotillard reaches for like a knife or a shiv right before falling asleep for the first time in Bruno's apartment. The other one is when she, or the second one is when she bites on the unpeeled banana in the bathhouse. The third one is when she steals cash from a hat while they're out to dinner. And then the fourth one is when she's at Ellis Island and she cuts her finger and uses it as uses the blood as lipstick. And these are moments where it's just like the combination of her performance and the kind of emotional directness of Gray's classical style is almost just overwhelming. How closely it aligns you with this character. And what's amazing is that I keep thinking of this movie as this incredibly emotional journey of this woman when it's really such a balanced two-character portrait. And Joaquin Phoenix's character basically in every way sort of trumps the cliche of the pimp drawing this woman into this kind of awful dark world of prostitution. He's such a complicated character in his own right. But yeah, this movie is just so overwhelmingly moving to me. And I think I've seen it three times, so I'd need to take a break from it.
Yeah, I think it might have been higher on mine if I had seen it more.
Yeah.
I saw it once, and I really want to revisit it. But if I had seen it again, it probably could have knocked itself into the top five.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw it for the first time at the 2013 New York Film Festival. And then the second time, which is the viewing that really clinched it, was when it came out in theaters. So there was a pretty good, unfortunately. So there's a pretty good, 6 or 7 month gap between the first two viewings. And yeah, I feel really fortunate to have seen this movie twice on a big screen.
I'm jealous. Because this movie lives for the big screen.
Yeah, I mean, just the close-ups of her and everything. It's
that gorgeous face.
Yeah, that's my number one. Marion Cotillard had a good year.
Indeed she did. Almost as good as Tilda.
And Liam.
Speaking of Liam Neeson...
Could it be?
Let's take a moment to really anticipate this and imagine what life will be like if Nick Newman's number one film of the year was actually Nonstop. Can we allow ourselves to live in that dream for just a little while longer?
I think the film stage would blow up.
Think about the life that you have now and how deeply and fundamentally it would change if you knew that Nick Newman, who has had the strangest string of movies that literally 14 people have seen for this entire list, were to then pull out all of the stops, and say, Nonstop. Okay, now that we've all thought about that, Nick Newman, what is your number one film of the year?
I feel like it'll be pleased and disappointed.
Okay.
Let me just say, it is not directed by Ame Colesera.
Damn it! Nick, you fucking promised!
Hey. I didn't necessarily break my promise. One second.
Okay.
My number one film of the year is James Gray's The Immigrant.
Okay, that works.
Which, and I didn't necessarily break my promise. Wink, wink. My number one film of the year is James Gray's The Immigrant, about an air marshal who's on an airplane. And, okay, so my number one film of the year is James Gray's The Immigrant, which, here's the weird thing that happened with this movie. The first time I saw this was with Danny, actually, on Friday, October 4th, 2013, the same day I saw Claire Denis' Bastards, which you might recall is my number one film of last year.
Yeah, that's a banner day for you.
Indeed it was. I also saw Gravity, unfortunately.
I liked Gravity, so fuck yourself.
No,
this is crazy that you both have The Immigrant at your number one. I feel bad now for not having it higher.
It is crazy.
Well,
it's madness.
But this does give us finally one film that all of us had.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's that, The Immigrant, a movie that really kind of, as I said when we reviewed it back in like May or June or wherever, whenever I said that it wasn't for me on a second viewing, revealed itself to be a much more complex work than I had initially perceived it, much more elegant work.
I should have done a fucking second viewing.
Well,
right there on Netflix.
It is. It is on Netflix as well. So you think I'm such you think I'm such an elitist. Like half of these films are on Netflix watches.
That doesn't mean shit. So is Thanksgiving. That doesn't mean anything.
But anyway. It's okay, like I said with Venus and Fur, it is a film kind of most of definitives, a movie that kind of has that hits every mark as the best of everything that I experienced this year, more or less, except I guess best 3D because it's good by language. But anyway, the point being that this is a movie that kind of sat with me the most over the course of 7 months or so. It's just various lines and images and sounds and gestures and all of these things that constitute a film, constitute a narrative film at least, stayed with me in a way I didn't expect. And when I was making my top 10, when I actually got down to the business of it, I kind of realized that this just makes sense as my number one more than anything else. You know, I mean, I love Venus and Fur. I love Only Lovers. I love Journey to the West. I love Close Curtain. You know, I mean, that could, if you were to put that in my number one spot, if you were to just switch that around, I wouldn't jump at you. I wouldn't totally object if I had to put it there.
I'm going to do that to you, just so you know. I'm going to edit this podcast so it sounds like Close Curtain is your first.
That's good. Do it. But this was the one that ultimately kind of, when I thought back upon it, it just seems the most logical to me, I guess. It's the one that kind of stands best as a number one. It has the most standing as a number one, is what I'm trying to say in so many words. It stuck with me in a way I wasn't really anticipating, especially since when I first saw it. I liked the movie a lot, but I didn't love it. And when I went to see it a second time, it was a big surprise. It's a really, truly great film, and one that has been terribly mistreated. Despite being put on Netflix Watch instantly, this movie came out fucking 7.5 months ago, and it's still not on home video. That doesn't make any sense, and there's no sign of it going on home video either.
There's no awards push or anything?
No, there's no awards push either, because Harvey Weinstein is a cunt, but
yeah, I agree.
So it is. Sometimes that happens. And it's a film of really delicate beauty, of incredible one, yes, it is a melodrama. It has melodramatic aspects, very clear-cut, tones and, mm-hmm. and narrative incidents. But it is also a film of incredible complexity. I mean, I haven't been able to stop thinking about Joaquin Phoenix's Bruno Weiss, who is, you know, maybe the great film character of 2014 for all I know. It is at the very least my favorite Joaquin Phoenix performance of the year. And I say that having seen the other one. I don't know.
No Inherent Vice on any of these lists.
No, two of us have seen it. Neither of us have it. So, Well, maybe we can get to that in a second. But
okay. We'll get to Nonstop.
Just like we'll get to Nonstop in a second. Anyway, I'm going on too long here. We've already talked about it a lot, and I'm talking about it. I've already talked about it a lot right here. The Immigrant's a beautiful film, and you know what? It's my number one. I'm going to keep it there.
All right. I really wish that I'd seen this movie more than once now.
We could all have the same number one.
We could. Can you let's take a moment now to imagine a world in which, despite all of our differences, we'd all had the same number one. It would be on par with the shock of To the Wonder showing up on everyone's list last year.
Oh, right.
After I had to fight tooth and fucking nail during that podcast. All right. Well, anyway, my number one film. I guess I can't even think of like how to build up to this because I'm just so upset about Nick not choosing Nonstop. Okay, so my number one film is a story of a man adrift in modern society who comes face to face with himself. It is Enemy, the film by Denis Villeneuve and starring Jake Gyllenhaal. This movie. When Jordan saw my list and was like, "Oh, Enemy at number one. That's weird." I said, "Yeah, it passed what I'm now calling the gray test."
Ooh.
Which is, the gray was my number one for that year, and it was because every time I saw a film, I continuously asked myself, "Is this better than the gray?" And the answer was constantly no. Since my rapturous response to Enemy and buying the Blu-ray and seeing it multiple times and forcing people to watch it, I have now held Enemy up to the gray test, and it has passed. Every film that I saw, I was like, yeah, that's pretty good. But I'm not going to watch it as much as Enemy. And I feel like these two movies have things in common. Not even in a thematic way, but just in the way in which they explore a thing and they exist completely independent of anything else, and they're self-contained and they're small and they're weirdly beautiful, and they have an ending that most people would shout like fuck you at the screen at, but that I found just perfect. Even though in the case of Enemy, I can't really tell you what the source of that perfection is, because the ending comes at first glance seemingly out of fucking nowhere. But yeah, Enemy, my number one film of the year. A film that I haven't even seen on a lot of other people's lists.
Yeah.
But for me, it was by far the my favorite film. I'm calling it my favorite film because I do believe that things like The Immigrant and Grand Budapest and Under the Skin, you know, might have been better. Even like, you know, Ida and Boyhood might have been better just because they did a little more, went a little further, but just from like a pure spot of like excellently crafted, really entertaining and thought-provoking filmmaking, like I can't not give this one number one. Like when I started this list, I had like 30 fucking films that I could have put on, and I started winnowing them away, but I wrote down Enemy at the number one spot and it never moved.
And that's Villeneuve's power.
Yeah. Yeah. Enemy. All right, so let's just hash out some honorable mentions, and then we'll be done. So, I'll begin. I'll begin with throwing out some stuff, and if you agree, just say yeah, and if you don't, say nothing. And then let's try not to have any repeats, unless you really feel like you need to talk about it. So honorable mention, for technical achievement and, interesting performances, Birdman. No? Okay, cool. For, a property that sounded like it was a terrible idea, but ended up being pretty awesome, Lego Movie.
Ooh, didn't see it.
No. Danny, what the fuck?
Yeah, I was really, didn't see many animated films this year.
Yeah, neither did I, actually. I was thinking about that. Anyway. For a movie that looked kind of dumb, but actually ended up being a whole lot of fun, and I could see myself watching over and 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 over again, Edge of Tomorrow.
Oh, yeah.
Walk Among the Tombstones, because Scott Frank and Liam Neeson. Whiplash, for being a damn good time at the movies. The Rover, because I love me some just really bleak as shit Australian cinema. Noah, for tackling biblical source material with a kind of literalism and earnestness that I never thought I would see on film. Not shying away from the weird shit, too. For using animation in a way that I thought was really excellent and interesting, even though the movie itself fell down on that a little bit. I will also talk about The Congress. And finally... Yeah. Yeah, I know. I knew that would get some shit. And then finally, because I love stop motion so much, and because this was an incredibly charming, entertaining film, I will say The Box Trolls.
Yeah. I did see that, unfortunately. I really like Laika, and I didn't get around to it.
Yeah, Paranorman made my list the year it came out, and The Box Trolls came close.
Yeah.
All right, other honorable mentions that you guys would like to throw out there. Nick, wait. Let's fucking talk about Nonstop. What happened?
Honorable mentioned.
Honorable mentioned.
I'll just give you my 15 through 11, I guess.
Okay.
There's Liv Ullmann's Miss Julie, which is a movie that got a very small release and nobody saw, which is too bad because it's...
How does that differ in any way from most of the films on your list?
Well, this one has Jessica Chastain and Colin Farrell in it.
Okay.
So I feel like it's a little odd.
Yeah, that is a little odd. I'd watch that movie just based on those names alone.
It is an immaculately directed film. Probably the best use of conversation in any film I've seen this year. Just an incredibly established rhythm between faces and bodies that Liv Ullmann creates. And when it's Chastain and Farrell, what faces and bodies they are, am I right?
Yeah, oh my God.
Number 14, there's actually, I watched this on a screener, right? I connected my Mac to my TV, and there's a scene in it where they're like making out really heavily, and my TV actually burst into flames when that happened.
Wait, really?
It actually burst into flames when they started kissing each other because it was just so intense, but...
I was hoping that you were like, I left a book on top of it and blocked the vent and it just burst into flames.
I was
hoping that was real.
That Miss Julie, it's a beautiful movie.
Okay.
Similar to Venus in Fur, actually. So if you have, that gives you a little key into some of my cinematic proclivities. Number 14 is indeed Nonstop, a movie that I have not forgotten in the 10 months since... I saw it. It's a beautiful movie. It is so exciting and so... I mean, a movie like this made with this kind of care is something I can't not appreciate. Similar to Stranger by the Lake, I suppose, in a way.
You couldn't have given it the spot inhabited by Stranger by the Lake?
I should have done a double feature. Fuck!
Yeah, damn it. And I would have been right, because I said number 5. Damn it.
My mistake. Brutal. Anyway. Right.
13.
I love Nonstop. I've said enough. 13 is Boyhood. There's literally nothing else to say. Number 12 is Nymphomaniac, a movie that I know I was a lot more positive on than the other people here. I think this could have ranked higher for me if I saw the 5.5-hour director's cut.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Which is currently on Netflix Watch Instantly. It just happened to come out.
What, fucking director's cut's on?
Oh, the direct. I didn't know.
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
It just happened to come out when I was in the middle of my 2014 catch-up, and it can be so exhausting, and I had already seen the movie, and I kind of felt like I'm already a really big fan of it. If it doesn't quite make it, so be it. It'll be here, and I think myself and Rafi Azdourian, who's a huge Von Trier fan, are the only people who actually represented it on their lists, which is kind of surprising. But we also seem to be something of outliers for really liking both volumes of it.
Yeah.
So it is. Number 11 is 2 Days, 1 Night, which ended up on Danny's list. It's a great film. Again, my 10 and 9 were kind of slightly political choices, hoping to give a little bit more exposure to films that I feel like haven't gotten quite enough exposure.
Like Nonstop. I don't feel like enough people saw Nonstop. I'll be honest.
Because everybody in America didn't see it.
Yeah, why? Come on.
I don't know. But, the thing, yeah, so 2 Days, 1 Night is a great film. It just didn't exactly fit into my list, I suppose. I could have double featured it with The Immigrant, but I don't want to double feature my number one spot.
Yeah, no, that's absurd.
Yeah, that seems like...
I feel like only 10 can be like a double feature. Because that's what I did for Only God Forgives and Spring Breakers, and that's what Danny did for Nonstop and Walk Among the Tombstones.
Yeah. So
double featuring a first choice. God, what are you, fucking crazy? Are you a communist?
This is one of my favorite Dardenne Brothers films, maybe my favorite for all I know. It's fantastic. I've seen it twice now, and it's a film of, I think, complexity, but one that can sort of play in a very naturalistic register, one that can play on a very sort of... not single-minded, but it can play on a single track very effectively as well. And that makes it sort of an exemplary achievement all its own, to say nothing of everything else that comes with it, in particular, you know, Cotillard's performance, which is absolutely fantastic. A good double billing with The Immigrant. If you want to see her play distressed women, this is the year for you, isn't it?
Yeah.
So those are the honorable mentions.
Nothing makes me happier than seeing Marion Cotillard look distressed.
Okay.
All right. Danny King, give us a couple of your honorable mentions, and then we can get the hell out of here and get drunk.
Yeah.
Get drunk.
One of them I already mentioned was Under the Skin. Another one that probably would have been on there without the double bill is Abuse of Weakness, which is also on Netflix Instant.
Okay.
Isabelle Huppert gives one of the best performances of the year as a... It's actually an autobiographical film on the part of the director, which makes the fact that the style is really removed and objective, it kind of makes that style all the more chilling, that she's kind of looking back on these events without trying to explain them at all. The story is basically Huppert's character, a film director, gets entangled with this weird relationship with a younger con man where she starts lending him obscene amounts of money, and he sort of takes advantage of her in that way. And
I mean, who wouldn't?
Yeah.
Must be that guy.
And so, yeah, the way the movie just refuses to explain it and just shows it is pretty fascinating. And her performance is kind of amazing. She's in a lot of scenes, she's on the floor. Her body is sort of writhing or, you know, doing insane things. And it's a pretty fascinating to watch. So check that out. Another one would be Goodbye to Language, which I've seen twice in 3D, but I just left it off my list because I haven't seen Godard's recent films. So I just feel like I'm so far away from understanding it that putting it on my top 10 would be weird. It would just be like, yeah, this is a really good movie, but I don't know what it's saying or doing. Another honorable mention would be The Homesman. Tommy Lee Jones's first Western in almost a decade that he directed, that is really good and really dark, and has also maybe been mishandled a little bit. I know that when I saw it, it's so strange that I assumed it would kind of get a lot of mixed reviews, but it's ended up having a lot of supporters, which has been encouraging. It's actually has a pretty high score on Rotten Tomatoes, which I never would have guessed. So that's good. Check that out. And then also the last one I'll mention is Love is Strange, the latest film from Ira Sachs. I also really liked his previous film, Keep the Lights On. And Love is Strange is another really good New York relationship drama. The last film sort of had unknown actors and a different kind of style. This one stars John Lithgow and Alfred Molina as an aging couple sort of forced out of their apartment. But it's equally moving and worth seeing. So, and also all the Clint Eastwood movies I've been marathoning are also honorable mentions.
Oh, yeah.
Big Hereafter fan?
Big Hereafter fan.
It is incredible that man makes so many movies that I forget most of them.
Yeah.
Like,
until you just said that, I was like, what is Big Hereafter? And then I parsed the sentence a little bit, and I was like, oh, Hereafter. Oh, fuck, that movie.
What if it was? What if it was called Big Hereafter?
I mean, you have to imagine that the Hereafter is pretty big, right?
It's yeah,
a lot of fucking people there. Anyway, doesn't matter.
But it's a pretty minor movie.
That man made two movies this year.
Yeah.
Good old Clint. Here's a random question. Just before we say goodbye, can any of you even think to name a movie that was like your least favorite of this year?
I mean, I try not to, just because I guess I'm just not really into like wallowing in that sort of negativity.
Yeah.
I mean, I hated the Congress. What else
was
there?
Thing, like, even if, like, I was thinking about it, and like my initial thought was going to be, "Listen up, Philip, haha," but like, even that one, I can still, like, I can't find the bile to call it the worst movie of the year. You know, You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, it just seems like that's very reductive. I would need to find something a little lazier, because that movie was at least trying something.
Yeah, I don't know. I tend to put movies I hate out of my mind.
That's
so
the other
thing
I feel like I can think of.
I feel like there was something that we reviewed that I really hated, but I can't put my finger on it.
That's bizarre.
I don't know. I'm sure there's something or another that really kind of stuck out to me as terrible, but thankfully it's disappeared from my memory.
Indeed. Yeah, no, I can't really think of anything.
Transcendence.
Well, you saw Transcendence, right?
Yeah. And
we don't even have that option. I was going to say, the other thing is that Nick is...
I don't know if it's as bad as the Congress, but you know what was like really just objectionable was X-Men Days of Future Past.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow. I forgot that even happened this
year. That was really terrible.
Yeah,
and
a
way that is really unjustifiable considering all of the... But that's like this year's Man of Steel for me, I guess. those are like the two that stand out.
Oftentimes, the movies that could be considered the worst, I feel like we get to dodge the bullet on because Nick Newman refuses to see them.
Yep.
And we end up watching some Scandinavian film. Speaking of which, one of our first reviews of the new year is going to be Force Majeure.
So, oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So look forward to that, ladies and gentlemen. We'll also be picking up on some of the prestige flicks that are out in limited release now. So hopefully things like American Sniper and I don't know what else is out will be out. Oh, Selma. Selma. I want to talk about Selma. So American Sniper and Selma, hopefully we'll get to talk about. Yeah, so that's
the Black Hat.
Black Hat is fucking wait.
Oh my god, I'm so excited.
Okay, good. I can. It's hard to tell sometimes when you're doing that noise.
No,
noise or a bad noise.
My man. I'm a man, man.
Yeah, I'm a man, man too, man.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I'm fucking excited as shit for that. So Black Hat. So it's gonna be a fun January, I think. And if there's one weekend where we can't find anything, we're gonna fucking get wasted and talk about some shit movie that we.
Labor Day is now on Netflix Instant.
Is it? I was gonna say, I don't know if Ninth Gate is still on Netflix Instant, but if Labor Day is, we're getting wasted and talking about Labor Day.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
God, I can't believe I'm gonna have to watch that.
You're gonna love it. And I'm going to love listening to you talk about it. So anyway, it's going to be a great 2015, folks. So, Happy New Year again. Let's tell you where we can be found in the meantime. Danny King.
Twitter.com/TheKingBulletin. TheFilmStage.com. And that's about it.
Nick Newman.
Filmstage.com, Twitter.com/Nick_Newman, and you can read my and all of my co-hosts' top 10 lists on thefilmstage.com.
Indeed you can, as well as all of our other wonderful end of the year coverage, which I feel like I contributed a shit ton to, and I'm sure that you guys did as well. All that is available at the Film Stage, where you can also find some more of my writing and this podcast page. You can also find me on Twitter, twitter.com/BrianJerone, and my personal site, dearfilm.net. That is all. So long, 2014. Hello, 2015. And as always, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us. There is Nick Newman, associate editor for the Film Stage.
There's a phone ringing in the background right now. Can you hear it? Okay, it's
louder. Okay, yeah.
Hello, Marshall Marks.
Marshall Marks. Is someone taking a shower right now?
No, that's a sink. Let me move upstairs.